It's a tax bill. It's a healthcare bill. It's a tax bill. It's a healthcare bill. Forget it, Jake. It's Washington. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 14th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Stop me, would you, if you've heard this one before? But the Senate of the United States is working on a health care bill. You might have missed it yesterday when President Trump said he wants the GOP to put a repeal of the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate into the tax bill it's working on. The individual mandate, of course, is what forces everybody in this country to buy insurance. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul took that suggestion and ran with it, formally proposing an amendment to the Senate tax bill today, which is going to make it into the final document. This is one of those plot twists that desperately needs a little bit of unpacking, so we've called Sarah Cliff. She is the senior policy correspondent at Vox, also the host of the new podcast called The Impact. Sarah, it's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So help me understand, assuming this thing passes, how this would work. The individual mandate goes away, and then what?
Then a lot of people lose health insurance. So what we know about individual mandate repeal is that it would cause about 13 million fewer people to have insurance. That's according to the Congressional Budget Office analysis. And this happens because you essentially see the healthy people drop out of the marketplace when they are not required to buy insurance. They might decide, you know what, I'm going to risk it. I'm not going to contribute. And that would lead to some pretty significant insurance loss.
And then rates, one assumes, for the not healthy people staying on insurance, they go up, right?
Exactly. So a lot of people expect you'd see something called a death spiral. With the healthy people exiting, the rates go up and up. We've actually seen a few states try to do health reform without a mandate. Washington State in the 1990s comes to mind. They had a death spiral happen. They had no insurance companies willing to sell coverage to individuals by the end of that experiment. We know that it doesn't work very well.
What happens to Medicaid, which is a huge part of this entire operation?
Yeah, so this is a bit interesting and surprising. CBO estimates that 5 million people would lose Medicaid if the mandate were repealed. They think that people would be less inclined to sign up for Medicaid if there was no requirement to carry health insurance. Now, right. Republicans have disputed this number. They think it doesn't make sense that people won't enroll in Medicaid, a free program, because the mandate goes away. And this is one of the reasons the CBO is actually revisiting their analysis of the individual mandate right now.
Is it fair for me to go back to some of our coverage of the health care bill in which I said, you know what, the health care bill, it's actually a tax bill. Is that panning out now? Is that really what we're seeing?
Yeah, it feels like deja vu that the two are very closely intertwined. I think one of the reasons you see the individual mandate coming up right now is that it raises a lot of revenue for the tax cuts that Republicans want to pursue. CBO estimates it would save the federal government $338 billion over the next 10 years if they repeal the mandate. Most of that comes from people losing insurance.
Right.
When fewer people have insurance, there's less money the government has to spend on subsidies.
And which then the government can use that money and put it toward other lower taxes for people and companies, it has to be said.
Exactly. Right. So it all really works together. Tax reform, health reform, they are not quite separate here in Washington. They seem to always be intertwined.
It's a tax bill. It's a health care bill. Anyway, we've seen this movie before thing going on here, right? Because we're waiting on Senator McCain, Senator Murkowski, and Senator Collins, all three of whom voted no on the original health care bill, to weigh in on this thing. And there's no sign that they're swayed one way or the other.
Yeah, it's been a pretty confusing afternoon on Capitol Hill. You have some leadership Republicans like John Thune saying, we have the votes, we have 50 votes to pass this. And then you have senators like Orrin Hatch, which chairs the Finance Committee that tax reform will run through, saying he doesn't want to revisit the individual mandate. We'll see some votes likely later this week, next week, the week after Thanksgiving. So it is definitely more likely that the Senate bill will include this. But, you know, as you guys have covered on this show, what happens in the Senate bill might not be final word. We're also getting rumblings from the House. They're not excited to revisit the individual mandate.
And we get to go back all over again. Sarah Cliff is the senior policy correspondent at Vox. She also hosts their new podcast. It is called The Impact. Sarah, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Traders have been banking on this tax bill, healthcare bill, tax bill for a good long while now. Their confidence, it should be said, seemed a little shaky today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There is going to be a theme to much of the rest of the program today, and it goes like this. Be careful what you wish for when you start dabbling in the global economy. Cautionary tale number one comes to us from the President of the United States, who is on his way home, after 12 days in Asia. Trade was a big chunk of his itinerary, and he is not happy with the status quo, as we all know. The United States has to be treated fairly and in a reciprocal fashion, he tweeted today. The massive trade deficits must go down quickly! Now, it has to be said that most economists disagree with the president on whether the current U.S. trade deficits are the problem he believes them to be. But let's play along here for a second and imagine what would happen if the president could reduce America's trade deficit quickly! Marketplace's Sabri Benishore is on that one.
Technically, it's easy to reduce the trade deficit.
Yes, there's a time-honored method of doing that, and that's to drive the economy into recession.
Edward Alden is with the Council on Foreign Relations. The U.S. trade deficit fell by half during the Great Recession because we stopped buying as many imports because we were in recession. The things that affect trade deficits, they're big things. Recessions, the strength of the dollar, not trade agreements.
There are no cases I can think of where the renegotiation of trade rules had any significant impact on trade deficits.
So to bring down the trade deficit quickly, you'd have to change big things in the economy. We could, for example, push the dollar lower to make our exports cheaper.
Unfortunately, what that would do is also begin to lead to inflation.
Doug Irwin teaches economics at Dartmouth.
There's always trade-offs.
Mary Lovely teaches economics at Syracuse. She says another big economic change that could reduce the trade deficit is
a very large tax increase.
Strange as it may sound, raising taxes would lower government borrowing from abroad, which technically drives the trade deficit. Raising taxes is obviously a no-no for Trump. So is inflation, so is recession.
However, the Trump administration tried to achieve the goal of reducing the overall trade deficit quickly. It would come into conflict with other very important Trump administration objectives.
The safest, most beneficial way to lower the U.S. trade deficit? Help other countries prosper economically so they buy more U.S. stuff. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Cautionary tale number two is congressional in origin. A bipartisan group of senators has agreed to take a big step in loosening up some of the banking regulations that were put in place after the financial crisis. Dodd-Frank is the law you're thinking of here. There is a deal apparently in the works that would excuse smaller and more regional banks from some of the regulations and testing meant to ensure that they can survive certain economic shocks. Stress tests, they have been called. Again, be careful what you... yada, yada, yada. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has that one.
Right now, financial institutions with assets over $50 billion are subject to extra regulation and oversight. They have to undergo stress tests to see how they do in another financial crisis. The bipartisan Senate deal would raise the threshold from $50 billion to $250 billion. That's great news for community bankers lobbyist Paul Mirsky.
You have about 80% of all the banking assets concentrated in about 10 banks, so that's where the real risk is.
Mirsky says it's hard for small community banks to pay for the extra staff needed to comply with the extra regulations. Free them up from that, he says, and they can compete better with the big guys, maybe get bigger themselves, maybe even acquiring another bank, says Brian Clock of Keefe, Bruyette & Woods.
You'll see a lot of those banks start to be more open about doing an acquisition that would take them over the $50 billion because now they wouldn't have to worry about stress testing.
All this does not sound good to Marissa Baradaran. She teaches banking law at the University of Georgia. She says when small banks merge into bigger regional banks, they close small branches that don't make much money.
And more mergers will definitely lead to more banking deserts, less bank branches, especially in areas of poverty.
Plus, Baradaran says a lot of small banks failed during the financial crisis. So she says they do need the extra regulation. These arguments will play out later this week when the bipartisan legislation is expected to be introduced. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Draper Fisher Jurvetson is one of the big names in Silicon Valley venture capital. Yesterday, one of the named partners, Steve Jurvetson, left the firm by mutual agreement, the press release says, amid a sexual harassment investigation. Given Silicon Valley's reputation on gender issues, shall we say, and the importance of venture capital in the tech ecosystem, we have called up Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech, to talk this whole thing over. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
The thing about Jurvetson and this news is, if you think down a couple of layers, the power that venture capital has in shaping how Silicon Valley and its companies get formed, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very unusual ecosystem, and you've got this, you know, pretty small group. They're almost like a priesthood. It's very secretive, and they're very powerful, and they control a lot of money.
And very male.
And they decide.
Much like the priesthood, right?
And very male, right, exactly. Right. And it's almost exclusively white men. They absolutely have a tendency to fund white men who look and act and think just like them. And so you start to get this kind of, you get an entire ecosystem that starts with the guys at the top. And, you know, there are horror stories coming out every day about female founders talking about how many meetings they went to where they got told no. Even if they didn't get sexually harassed, most of the time they also got told no. And very often, unfortunately, they had both.
You had Jurvetson on Tech, right?
We did. So we interviewed Steve Jurvetson. And what's so interesting is that, you know, as these conversations start to heat up in the Valley, you think a lot about the people who are not in the room, the people who never got that funding. And there's one thing that Jurvetson said that now is really sticking with me about who's not in the room.
What's not reported because they're invisible are the folks who get nothing. There's actually a bunch of really interesting business ideas that withered on the vine. Certainly a lot of Google competitors. I can tell you that for certain.
The thesis here being that women are underrepresented in tech in part because they don't get VC money.
Yeah. And Steve Jurvetson essentially said to me in that interview, look, every venture capitalist comes in and spends their first 5 or 7 or 10 years pulling from their Rolodex. And if you play that all the way forward and you think about the impact of, you know, a sixth of the world's capital being invested out of Sand Hill Road, if you have rot there, you can see how kind of profoundly systemic it is, and that just makes it really hard to root out.
Sand Hill Road, of course, being the place in Menlo Park where all the big VC firms, most of them anyway, the big ones, are located. Let me ask you this, though, and take this from VC to the larger bro culture in Silicon Valley. Here we have Weinstein, and we have issues in public radio, and now we have them in politics. Where are the stories coming out of Silicon Valley about harassment and abuse?
Silicon Valley, in many ways, in the last decade or so, became the new Wall Street. So a lot of people came here to get rich quick. And whenever you have a culture like that, you're going to get a skewed set of incentives. And then you have this kind of other factor, which is, you know, I actually, for Marketplace Tech tomorrow, talked to Ellen Powell, mm-hmm. who was a partner at Kleiner Perkins, mm-hmm. you know, was sort of the Eve in the origin story of unraveling sexual harassment in Silicon Valley. And one of the things she said is that you do have this extremely small set of people with a lot of power making a lot of the decisions about who gets funded and what companies are born.
Without wanting to presage the news in any way, do you doubt that there will be stories coming out of Silicon Valley about harassment and abuse as this trend that we are now seeing in other industries continues?
Oh, no. In fact, it makes me nervous about anyone I interview, to be honest, because I suspect there will... There are unquestionably going to be more because, you know, we've heard the words open secret bandied around.
Yeah.
It is an open secret that there's a lot about the Valley that is very bad.
Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech. Tomorrow, Ellen Powell, formerly of Reddit, also Kleiner Perkins. I'm sure you read about that. She'll be talking to Molly. Molly, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up.
Everybody presumes that the government is there to protect you. If they were here to protect you, they wouldn't let this go on at all.
Fracking's unintended but perhaps foreseeable consequences. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 30 points today, about a 10%, 23,409. NASDAQ down 19 points, 0.2%, 6737. The S&P 500 sagged 5 points lower, 0.2%, 2578. Talked earlier about banking regulations. U.S. Bancorp deposited 0.2% today. Bank of America and JPMorgan Chase both withdrew 0.6%. The world of retail fashion continues to lose its sparkle in the lead up to the big holiday shopping season. TJX Companies, that oversees TJ Maxx and Marshalls, dressed down after its latest earnings report missed expectations. TJX cut 3.9% today. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.37%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Picking up on what Sabri was talking about earlier, the trade deficit and the closing thereof, there is a part of this economy where the trade gap is getting smaller. Oil and gas. A new report out from the International Energy Agency is predicting kind of amazing growth in the U.S. shale oil production, a growth rate that, get this, compares to Saudi Arabia at its fastest. The agency says the United States is eventually going to sell more oil than it buys. Good news for the Trump administration and every president back to Nixon, in point of fact, all of whom talked about getting off foreign oil. But in keeping with today's theme, best be careful what you wish for. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that.
Once upon a time, the U.S. produced all the oil it used. Then we needed more and couldn't keep up, started importing. But the shale oil boom could have us meeting our own needs and sending some to others. Pavel Molchanov analyzes energy for Raymond James. He says other wealthy countries have had this happen. The U.K. and China at times, and our neighbors.
Canada is a net exporter of oil today and by a large margin.
Those economies can hint at what might happen here. The energy sector grows, but other industries could decline, notably manufacturing. Trevor Hauser is with research firm The Rhodium Group.
If the oil and gas trade deficit declines, that puts upward pressure on the value of the dollar, which then makes other manufactured goods less internationally competitive.
Other effects lean toward the political. Elected officials have long proclaimed the benefits of energy independence. No supply threats due to overseas oil embargoes or shortages or wars.
And now we get to see whether that actually translates into the transformation of the U.S.'s geopolitical position in the world.
But he says being a net exporter of oil doesn't open some magic door to peace and prosperity. The U.S. economy is connected to the rest of the world by more than just oil. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
It's been about a decade now that the fracking-driven oil and gas boom in this country has been going on. And pretty much since it began, people who live near the wells, and remember, you got to shoot high-pressure water and chemicals down into layers of rock to get the good stuff out. Pretty much since the boom began, people have been worried about the mixture getting into their water and making them sick. Now, new documents shared with Marketplace reveal that the Environmental Protection Agency, which is theoretically in charge of these sorts of things, has some previously undisclosed health concerns about some of those fracking chemicals. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has the first of two stories.
This is the sound of an energy revolution in southwestern Pennsylvania. It's high-pressure water, plus chemicals and sand shooting down a well. Now, all this fractures the rocks below and releases the natural gas inside. Fracking. Now we're going to focus on those chemicals and what happens if people get exposed.
When they did the fracking and the water run off here, that's when I received most of the damage.
That's Brian Lactanich at his home in the hills of rural Pennsylvania, smack in the middle of the largest natural gas region in the country. It's known as the Marcellus Shale. Lactanich sold Chevron the right to drill on his property 7 years ago, but he thinks that fracking chemicals polluted his water well and it made his family sick. His son Ryan is a 7-year-old redhead, likes to box with his dad. 4 years ago, this happened to Ryan in the bathtub.
His mother screams upstairs like bloody murder, "Brian, come on up here. Something's wrong with Ryan." And he came out with rashes that were beyond poison ivy or oak.
Here's what he thinks happened. The fracking chemical mix went down the gas well, came back up, and got stored in a pit on his property. Now, these pits are supposed to be lined with plastic to prevent leaking, but Lactanich has pictures suggesting his was not.
And they pulled the liners out. That's frack water.
The state of Pennsylvania found that the drilling company, Chevron, illegally dumped frack water on his property. Since Ryan's bath had led to the rash, he got diagnosed with asthma, and worse.
My son has become incontinent and defecating himself almost on a daily basis from just some of the use of this water, apparently.
They started buying bottled water for everything. Lactanich has struggled to get answers to all these medical problems. The state tested his water and declared it safe. Local hospital tests on Ryan found nothing wrong. But other tests by universities on their water found high levels of bromide, chloride, manganese, uranium, all associated with fracking chemicals. Brian himself has been diagnosed with neuropathy, a kind of nerve damage that causes joint pain.
My son came to me last week. He said, "Dad, you cry in your sleep."
These are the health complaints and the mysteries you hear a lot near the oil and gas fields of America. Pennsylvania residents alone filed 9,000 drilling complaints about pollution and well problems from 2004 to 2016. That's one complaint for every well drilled. Federal scientists have concluded that oil and gas production can pollute water in several ways, though it's hard to prove cause and effect between a chemical and an illness. Western Pennsylvania pediatrician Edward Kattire fears a crisis in the making.
A lot of the harmful effects occur many years after the exposure. A good example would be asbestos, many years later shown to cause mesothelioma. By the time the association is made, it's too late for many, many people.
Still, several published studies have found less direct medical correlations. In Colorado, the closer you live to a well, the higher your cancer risk. In Pennsylvania, the greater the chance of low birth weight babies. Kattire says children are particularly at risk.
They play in the dirt. They play in streams. They don't necessarily wash their hands before they eat. I mean, they come in pretty close contact to the dark and dirty around us.
All these concerns raise the question, where are the regulators? The EPA in Washington approves new chemicals. And it turns out the agency okayed more than 40 drilling and fracking chemicals with known risks from 2003 to 2014. What risks? Poisoning of the brain and lungs and liver, according to agency documents, and tumors, and poor development in infants and fetuses. These are the findings of hundreds of new documents released under the Freedom of Information Act to the environmental group Partnership for Policy Integrity. Dusty Horwitt is an investigator there.
It's troubling to read these documents and to see EPA say, we think this chemical could be neurotoxic and another chemical could have developmental toxicity, and then approve these chemicals for use with very light regulation, if any.
The documents include chemical manufacturer applications and the EPA health risk assessments. Now, the EPA can go back and ask companies to do chemical safety tests. But for all the drilling and fracking chemicals approved, it asks for testing less than 10% of the time. That's according to Horwitt's analysis of the documents. So who is testing for safety?
In many cases, no one is testing. The companies tell EPA that they don't have health testing information on the chemicals on a regular basis. EPA regularly does not ask for health testing data. The EPA and the public are, to a large degree, operating in the dark.
He's not the only critic. Congress's watchdog arm, the Government Accountability Office, has repeatedly found that EPA does not have enough data to check chemical risks thoroughly. The EPA did not respond to our questions about its approval of fracking chemicals despite the agency's knowledge of the risks. An industry group, the American Chemistry Council, responded to us with a statement. It noted that Congress last year passed stricter rules for the EPA to approve new chemicals. Of course, those old chemicals are still out there, in and around Brian Lactanich's house in Pennsylvania.
Everybody presumes that the government is there to protect you. If they were here to protect you, they wouldn't let this go on at all.
It's not just the pollution that he believes is all around him. He has a separate beef with the system, that he's not allowed to know what the exact chemicals are that he may have been exposed to. Federal rules allow a high degree of secrecy. And that's the focus of our story tomorrow. In southwestern Pennsylvania, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, good news for delinquent parkers in New York City. The New York Post reports the city's Department of Finance has voided $26 million worth of parking tickets because traffic agents, apparently unbeknownst to them, had put the wrong infraction code on tickets slapped on more than 500,000 windshields. The infraction in question, by the way, failing to put or having an expired parking meter receipt on your dashboard. So if that's you, today's your lucky day, yo. All right, it's quitting time. The Dow off 30 points today, about a 10%. NASDAQ off 19, 0.2%. The S&P 500 sagged 5 points, about 0.2% there as well. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. There is one more name to mention on the way out today. Adrienne Hill has done, I think, every on-air job we have. She has hosted every program, reported every kind of story. She has done live shows and videos. And now she says it is time for her to do something else. She is one of the good ones. And believe me when I tell you, we're going to miss her. Well, we're going to miss her until she comes back to fill in for me while I'm off for Christmas. After that, she'll really be gone. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.